This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hi, I'm Ahmad Fuad Rahmat and welcome to Night School, the show that explores key themes in history, the social sciences and the humanities. Together with Sharat Kutten, we critically unpack theories, frameworks and social phenomena to better to understand how society works. Each week we discuss a classic text, theme or an idea that we hope to shed light on the world around you. Sharat is still off, but we are joined by Dr. Carl Bell, all the way from Australia, who is an independent scholar who's maintained a consistent fascination towards the Indian diaspora in Malaysia over many decades by now. And it'll be great to hear what he has to say, in particular about Thaipusam, which he's been giving talks about recently. Welcome to the show.
Well, thank you very much. I'm very pleased to be here.
Glad to have you here. You know, I was reading a lot about your background in preparing for the show, and I just can't help but say that it's fascinating. You know, I feel that the more I read about you, the more intriguing it became. I know that you were part of the Australian Foreign Service in Malaysia in the 1970s.
Yes. I came here in 1976 and I stayed here for 3 years, and I worked in the Australian High Commission for those 3 years. And my son was born here as well. Wow. So there is an intimate connection with Malaysia, if you like.
But what happened after the past 3 years that made you want to come back and maintain your interest in the country?
Oh, well, there's a number of things. I found Malaysia a fascinating country in its own right, as a country coming to terms with the post-colonial traumas of, if you like, that have been bequeathed by the British. But the general layers of culture within Malaysia, particularly within the component ethnic groups, and the interaction between them just absolutely fascinated me. And I think it's probably true to say that Anthony Burgess once wrote that Malaysia is a country that any historian can be absorbed in, and I would agree with that absolutely.
But more than the political atmosphere, it seems that you were drawn to the spiritual aspect of life here as well, right? Because I just got a video of you giving a talk about your spirituality. I mean, was that connected to your time in Malaysia too, or was that coincidental?
Yes, that was connected. I came up here as an agnostic, no longer believed in the or could relate to the tradition I was brought up in. And I found when I came here that unless I understood a lot more about religions, I was not going to understand Malaysia. And my wife's an anthropologist by training. We took an active interest in the people we mixed with, and we wanted to know more about them and their cultures and their backgrounds. And I think it's true to say that if you take one step towards Malaysians, they take 20 towards you. And we got lots of invitations to various functions. And this opened my eyes to the concept of spirituality and how that might relate to me personally.
Now, what interests me in that is how you were eventually more drawn to the Hindu / broader Indian tradition. I mean, which is rather different than the general story we have of Westerners coming to the country and noticing Islam more than others. And that would be part of their narrative of discovery here. But you were drawn rather to a minority expression of religion here.
You're quite right. That's a common observation. I first saw Thaipusam in 1978, and I was utterly intrigued. It's something that is just beyond my own scope of spiritual background. And I was just could not believe what I was seeing and the feelings that I got from devotees participating. And I actually went back in 1979. A friend was taking a Kavadi, and I followed him from the beginning at the riverside right up to the top of the caves. And at that point, I was still undecided as to where I would go. And it was actually after I went back to Australia that I had a series of experiences that led me more to explore that. So it was after that that I decided to return to Malaysia and participate in Thaipusam as a pilgrim.
Now, why still Malaysia at that point? Because that was some years since you left, and the Indian diaspora is huge, right? You could have gone to Tamil Nadu. I'm pretty sure you did, but somehow Malaysia retains your fascination. So what is it about the Malaysian articulation of Thaipusam or Hinduism that continues to compel you?
Well, I suppose actually the main reason I came back here was that I had friends and a support network that were able to assist me. And I, of course, at that point, I had no knowledge of Taipusam beyond Malaysia. And in that fact, beyond Batu Cave. So, for example, I'd never seen Taipusam at Penang or Ipoh. Mm-hmm. I had seen other ceremonial type of activities that were done in estates and places like that. But I suppose at that point, I thought mainly of Malaysia. I had invitations to visit Singapore, but I had a support network here, which was able to provide me with the sort of background and experiences that I needed.
You know, I actually haven't been to a Taipusam yet, and largely it's because I overanalyze things, and I know it's such a spectacle. It's something that really consumes all your senses to be a part of the atmosphere. And I've heard countless accounts of how people are somehow always transformed or moved by what they see and feel, you know. So tell us about how you experienced that exactly. I mean, was it the conception of the sacrificial self that drew you to it? Was it the music? I mean, what was it particularly that sparked that intrigue?
Well, that's probably a fairly difficult question to answer. I think it's all of those factors that you mention. I think that the sacrificial part is certainly something that I had never anticipated. So, yes, the music, the general devotional atmosphere, the attitude of reverence, if you like. I know there are critics of Taipusam who say that it's become just a carnival. Mm-hmm. But if you look at the theoretical works on carnival, of course, they go deeper than the populist meaning. But I found that the religious aspect actually really appealed to me, somehow engaged me. Mm-hmm. So that basically was, and somehow it got into me and I couldn't let go. Mm-hmm.
So let's start with that then. What makes Taipusam in Malaysia unique then? If you were to explain it to somebody who has no clue about it, so somebody in Australia who's wondering, okay, why you keep going back to Malaysia, what's going on there? I'm sure you got those questions, right? And it's very hard to start even explaining what Taipusam is because there's so many dimensions to it. So what was your strategy when trying to kind of clarify?
Well, I found it very difficult. And in actual fact, I've found that people in Australia, but particularly in Canberra, really didn't understand what I was on about. And many of them thought that perhaps I'd taken leave of my senses. And it was very difficult to explain because this is something that's light years away from the sort of spiritual experience that most Australians associate with religion. So basically, I would just say that it's a form of self-sacrifice, of submission. It's a move during the fasting period to away from the mundane time, if you like, into a sort of sacred time dimension. And the whole experience becomes an act of pilgrimage. Mm-hmm. All religions have pilgrimage. And of course, for Muslims, it's the Hajj, which is the ultimate religious experience. Mm-hmm. For a lot of Hindus, it's in Malaysia in particular, it's Taipusam. Mm-hmm. And the second part of your question is what makes it unique in Malaysia? I think it's the size here. Hindus in Malaysia, or Indians in Malaysia, comprise 7.4% of the population, and Hindus only 85% of that. And yet Taipusam in Malaysia is the largest and most vibrant Hindu festival celebrated outside India. Mm-hmm. It's a huge occasion.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, a lot of what you said just now about transitioning from mundane time to sacred time and devotion can be said roughly more or less about most spiritual traditions. But what stands out to me is a particular deployment of the body in this case. There's something that is being stated through the somatic engagements, right, through piercings and cuts and so on and so forth. How do we understand that? Because there's a lot going on and sometimes we don't even know the right words to use to describe it. I mean, where does the body, or the particular use or technique over the body, fits into that, what you said earlier about that devotion and transition from mundane to spiritual time and so forth?
Well, appreciate the look. You have to look at the mythology of how Taipusam originated. Mm-hmm. And it originates from the idea of a demon transporting hills which contain sacred wisdom from North India to South India. He confronts the god Murugan in the south. He is slain and then transformed into a devotee because he's looked into the sight of God and he has been transformed. at that point, Murugan says to this demon Idumban, henceforth you will stand as my servant, you will stand at the gate of my temples, wherever I am worshipped. But because you carried the two hills down, everybody that bears a burden the way you bear the burden will be blessed. So that is the origin of the Kavadi. But there's more to it than that, because, you know, you mentioned the piercings. The idea of going through a particular phase of trance is to reach a state where you're prepared to be, if you like, embraced or filled with a particular, the imprint of that deity. And so that is the sort of trance state. So there's two things to it. Firstly, the vowels that go through the tongue signify silence, which is you've given up the gift of speech for that particular period of time. But the rest of it says that you've gone to the point where pain and awareness is replaced with a sort of divine love or a divine grace. And so you don't feel the pain, you don't shed any blood. And this is, if you like, living proof of the power of that particular deity or the deities that worship. Because, of course, as you know, Hinduism in Malaysia is incredibly heterogeneous. And while this is a festival for Murugan, other deities are also recognised during that time.
Now, what strikes me as curious about that is the appeal of sacrificing itself, right? I mean, and it goes against modern liberal sensibilities where the self is just always contained and the self is all you need, whereas the idea of a sacrifice, and what more a sacrifice that is so expressed to that extent, shows the need to give, the need to release that part of you, that it is not enough for us to just look inwards in one direction, right? That to me is fascinating. And again, while all religions offer that and offer a way out of yourself, offer a way out of your ego, there's a certain intensity that Thaipusam displays.
Yes, you're quite correct. There is an intensity. And yes, it does disagree with the notion of the liberal self, which is particularly pronounced in the West, as you know. And the whole idea is that you give some time to the pursuit of the sacred. And that's done in various ways in various religions. But the experience of Thaipusam and the trance states and the transformation make that a great deal more intense than perhaps the idea of meditation or simple act of prayer or something similar to that, you know, just a general devotional act. It is actually focus, if you like, for a particular form of intense devotion.
Have you ever lifted a Kavadi yourself?
Yes, I've taken 22.
Wow, okay, okay. And I want to probe more on that process once we come back. Let's take a break for now. You're listening to me, Ahmad Fuad Rahman. Our guest this week is Dr. Carl Bell, who has researched extensively on Thaipusam, among other aspects of Hindu and Tamil life in Malaysia. We'll be right back after this break. This is Night School on BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, you're listening to me, Ahmad Fuad Rahmat. This is Night School. We have with us Dr. Carl Bell, an expert on Hinduism in Malaysia, particularly focusing on the Southern/Tamil diaspora. And recently you've been giving talks on Thaipusam, which is what we're talking about today as well. I want to talk about your Kavadi experience soon, but I wonder, as a researcher from the West, especially at a time when academia was just opening up to notions of Orientalism, of power disparities between the Western modes of knowledge and the longer history of conquest that saw the movement, you know, from the so-called global north or the global south looking for knowledge and archiving, so on and so forth. So power was a concern at that time for researchers in the social sciences, the humanities. I mean, how did you situate your own pursuits within that discourse? Was it a concern of yours that you're coming here for a certain privileged standpoint to what is largely a third world and, you know, disenfranchised group?
That's an interesting point that you raise. And I've always considered that, if you like, there are exceptions, but there's three basic schools that I've thought on Thaipusam, of which I'm very critical. And the first is the one you described as Orientalism, the distance from the other. Thaipusam is a sort of exotic East type experience, and as a source of entertainment, if you like, for the West. And some of these articles become quite contemptuous, and the benighted native type approach, which I find very objectionable. The second is the Lost Village Tradition School, which looks at typewism as something that has been brought to Malaysia by illiterate coolies and somehow transported here, but it has no mythical or scriptural justification. And the third school, of which I'm equally critical, is that of the psychoanalytic school, which looks at typism as a sort of abreacted sexual impulses of young men. The involvement of women or of ethnic Chinese or of older devotees is conveniently overlooked to make the evidence fit the theory. But having said that, I would say there are a couple of scholars, the work of Lawrence Babb and Dr. Raymond Lee of ex-University Malaya, have been very good on typism, and their work stands out as shining examples among those that I've just mentioned. But I wanted to do something which, yes, I did come here as a privileged Westerner, but also I'm writing from inside the tradition, and I wanted to write about typism not as so much as the observed, but as actually as a participant who was using a scholarly approach to look at typism. So I felt that given the knowledge that I'd been provided over so many years by so many people, if in a way I had an obligation to try and transmit that to a wider audience. So that is the approach I've taken. And I've been very aware of the Orientalist approach, and I've sought to avoid that.
As a spiritual person, how do you square yourself with being also an empiricist, right? So you have the socio-economic reading of typism's origins.
Yeah.
Even today, there are often references of particular class anxieties behind the people who take out a kavadi, the economic pressures behind maintaining that practice, the amount you have to save and the build-out, so on and so forth. I mean, how do you resist not reducing it to just that, like socio-economic, empirical pressures, you know, because you're a spiritual person, right?
Yeah, no. Well, I would I challenge some of the stereotypes that have been put forward. I mean,
such as, can you share some?
One for example that's put forward is the one you've just mentioned, the socioeconomic factor. In actual fact, typism involves a large range of socioeconomic groups. And for example, the group I'm associated with are nearly all professionals, lawyers, accountants, doctors, people like that. The other thing is that typism now reaches beyond the Tamil population. It includes people who are not traditionally regarded as South Indian. So you get Punjabi, Sikhs, Gujaratis, elements of the minority communities. But in Penang, for example, something which really amazed people when I talked about it when I went to India is the involvement of ethnic Chinese, which is something that people in India find almost impossible to believe.
So what explains that expanding appeal to non-Tamils?
I think this reflects general processes that are going on within the Hinduism in Malaysia. The Hindus that came to Malaysia came from a very segmented society, and there's a huge range of traditions that they brought with them. And I think the two things that are actually occurring among Hinduism in Malaysia is firstly the Tamilization of Hindu religion. And that leads to a lot of very syncretic outcomes, but it actually means that Murugan is being accepted by, if you like, the non-Tamil segment of the Hindu population. But also these discourses influence each other in various ways. The second is the one that in India would be called Sanskritization. In other words, village traditions are taken. They are linked, if you like, to so-called higher traditions and are reworked to fit within that. So, for example, the god Munaswaran, who was brought to Malaysia and Singapore mainly by railway workers, and he is then linked to Shiva, and the behaviour in temples changes accordingly to fit with that rejigged model of who Munaswaran is. And that sort of thing is occurring all the time.
So it's always been evolving, it's always been adapting. It's just this, what we're seeing in the inclusion of so-called non-Tamils more recently, it's just part of that natural process.
I think so. I mean, the colonial attitude was that there was a great tradition of Hinduism and there was a village tradition. And the two had no, if you like, exchanges. But various scholars have disproved that theory. In actual fact, the history of Hinduism has been one of negotiation, of reworking of boundaries over centuries. And Malaysia is a good example of how that process is continuing, if you like, within a non-metropolitan context.
You know, I imagine the amount of research that you've had to do to get to this level of perspective, right? Historical, social, and spiritual, did not happen overnight. And you've had to learn the language. You probably had to learn dead languages along the way, I assume. At what point did you realize, okay, this is what I'm going to devote myself to? You know, because all these obstacles ahead of you, and you could have given up at any point, but you persisted anyway.
Once I realised that my public service career was coming to an end, I realised, and people encouraged me to go into this field. They said, you know, you're a Westerner that's come into this tradition. You should write about it. You should let people know of your experiences and give them the so-called benefit of my knowledge. In actual fact, it took, and you're quite right, it took years to get to this point. It's a slow and incremental process, and the idea of an instant body of knowledge being transferred to you is something that comes in fairy tales, not in real life. So I probably decided round about 1983, 84, that this was my future. This is where I should be going. And then, of course, once I started to study traditional Tamil society and the links between India and Peninsular Malaysia and Peninsular Malaya and the links between China and these great trading networks, I was a lost cause. It really, to me, is just an incredibly fascinating topic.
I ask that because I think you're in a very interesting position to connect the broader circumstance of Tamil politics and how that's corresponding or projected onto Taipusa in general, right? Because in that period that you're here, so many drastic changes happened to the Tamil community, right? You're talking about the mass migrations from the privatization of their states the rapid urbanization, the kind of emergence of a Tamil proletarian class and the newly built urban centers in the 80s, so on and so forth. Like, how was Taipusa located in those changes? Did it gather a different tone or did it remain somewhat immune socially? Andrew Wilford's work, Cage of Freedom, is interesting as well because he pointed out to the resurgence of a particular Hindu revivalist discourse in the 80s as well, right? So can you explain a little bit about the social evolution of Taipusa between back when you started and today?
Again, that is an interesting phenomenon because you're quite right. You know, there was this huge migration from the estates. There's been a huge change in the Indian population. But also, I think it reflects perhaps the political structure of Malaysia, that Indians feel an affinity with their religion, which is a form of identity which they can't find in the political sphere or any other, in the cultural sphere. I mean, the traditional role that Indians played in the development of the Malaysian economy is generally not recognised, and the contributions today are not really recognised either. So I think there is this element that religion then becomes a focal point. Certainly, Wilford is quite correct. When I first saw Taipusam in 1978, the crowd at Batu Caves was estimated at 500,000 and the number of Kavadi worshippers was estimated at about 4,000 to 5,000. And those numbers have grown astronomically since that time. I mean, this year they said 1.3 to 1.4 million people at Batu Caves, 300,000 at Penang. It's a significant crowd, and the number of those who actually bear cavities has risen quite substantially as well. So I tend to think there's an increasing fervour and increasing commitment. But a lot of Hindus also feel challenged in various ways, and I think to fall back on their religion is perhaps a defence mechanism. But having said that, this revival is also occurring in other diaspora locations. For example, South Africa, post-apartheid South Africa, Mauritius, Fiji, where there are Indians face a number of problems, but Sri Lanka, places like that, there's also a large revival going on.
How would you characterize then? Because we've mentioned researchers, scholars, and numbers, and How would you characterize the state of Tamil studies in Malaysia? Like, is it still contained within sort of the same circle of few researchers, or like Taipus himself is expanded to include more outside interests?
Yeah, I think there's more. You quoted Wilford before. Mm-hmm. Wilford is a very good example of somebody who has done a great deal of work on Tamil society. And I think there is an increasing interest in, if you like, minority communities within, for want of a better word, newly developing countries. Mm-hmm. But yes, you're quite right. That a lot of the time, the work was being done by the Department of Indian Studies at the University of Malaya. But since that time, there's been a number of, if you like, people that have come out of the estates or an estate background who have challenged the dominant ethos that was written by, say, people like Arasaratnam or mm-hmm. Kurnail Singh Sandhu, who have looked more at, if you like, subaltern studies and the study of Indians on the estates or studies of transformation. I'm thinking of people like Dr. Nagarajan or Dato Ambalakan, who are Professor Ramasamy, who have done these sorts of works and looked at things, if you like, from the ground up rather than from the top down.
Mm-hmm. So you yourself have contributed to the discourse. You had a book recently, 2015, so it's still new, Tragic Orphans, Indians in Malaysia. How did you position that in the discourse in general, or was it just for a general audience?
That's more a generalist book. Mm-hmm. And what it does is it looks at the Indian presence from the time of colonialism to the current age and how Indians were disadvantaged in many ways by the experiences of colonialism, the British policy of divide and rule, if you like, and how the idea of independence left the Indians, if you like, sandwiched between Malay political strength and Chinese economic dominance, and, if you like, almost as a lost community. So I'm looking at that and the social problems and the, if you like, sclerotic Indian political engagement, both within the BN and the opposition, that really they found it very hard to get an effective voice that might deliver for that community.
Do you sense a positive future then for Malaysian Tamil studies or Malaysian Indian studies? Do you feel that it's going the right direction?
Well, I think there have been some interesting studies done, and yes, I think this sort of analysis, Wilford's book, for example, The Way of the Tamils and the Haunting of Justice, is one I believe that should be read by policymakers. It's a really comprehensive study, and he shows the effect the forced, if you like, evacuation of the estates has had upon the Indian community and how it's disadvantaged them in many ways. That sort of thing is needed for policymakers to read. But generally, there have been some other interesting books that have been published, both in the religious sphere and also in the general Indian studies sphere. The difficulty is, as Lim Tek Gee said when he was launching my book, and Malaysians don't tend to read all that much.
Yeah, I would have to agree on that, yeah. In any case, we are going to wrap up soon, but before that, we'd like recommendations for you. I mean, I would recommend this book, I mean, since you just mentioned it, Tragic Orphans, Indians in Malaysia. That's available by and large at most general bookstores.
Yeah, I would think so, yes. Yeah. It was published by the Institute of Southeast Asian Studies, as is my Taipusam book.
Great, great. So what is that Taipusam book called?
The book is called Taipusam in Malaysia, a Hindu festival in the Tamil diaspora. But I have to say that it focuses more on Batu Caves than Penang.
Mm-hmm. How about books that were influential in your own journey in trying to understand Malaysia better, the Tamil diaspora here better? Are there books, for me personally, that I keep turning to? I mean, my research, there are books that I just keep turning to year after year, you know, even when I know what it's already saying. But there's something about rereading them that sparks certain ways of thinking, you know, that I find productive. Do you have books like that in your time?
Well, the great seminal studies were those of Arasaratnam and Kurnail Singh Sandhu. But they're now completely out of date, under the 1969 and 70. And since then, you've had the developments of 1969, the new economic policy, the Mahathir years, and Malaysia has been completely transformed. And you've also had the rise of Bhuma Putra middle class, which is certainly a great effect on the way Malaysia now comports itself. So there needs to be a really rigorous review of all of that. But I looked at those two books and I thought basically they needed updating and to bring the whole position of Indian studies up to date. And I interviewed a large number of people, but I also was fortunate in that I was able to work with people that are actually involved in that particular field. And there's quite a lot of work being done on specific subjects in that area I was able to tap in on and continue with.
Fascinating. So what's the best way for our listeners to get in touch with you? Are you on Twitter, Facebook? Maybe?
Where I live is in rural South Australia. it's almost, but probably email is the best
email,
way.
Well, they can email the show and we can forward the messages
that
to you.
That would be fun.
bfmnightschool@gmail.com is the email address. Look us up on Facebook too, BFM Night School. Just type that in the search space. Also, don't forget to download our app. The BFM app is available to you on the Apple App Store or Google Play. And that way you'll be able to follow the show and other shows from the station. Thanks so much again, Dr. Bell. It's been great talking to you.
No, look, it's been a pleasure to be here. Thank
and
you very much
for having
me.
We'd love to have you again, the next time you're in town. Once again, I'm Ahmad Fuad Rahmat, and our guest today was independent scholar Dr. Carl Bell, and this is Night School on BFM 89.9, the business station.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.